evening, everybody. We got two sessions left in this particular study. We're going to look at some of the New Testament backgrounds of Jesus and his ministry, just kind of touch on the early church, and then next week we'll be off for Thanksgiving, and then the following week we'll meet again. There's a lot about backgrounds. We run this course this semester for information, but also in tandem with people who are going to be traveling on our Israel trip, which is end of December, end of January. And if you've ever been to Israel, or if you know much about, if you've been in the Middle East much for work or for travel, for tourism, a lot of moving parts within the history that Westerners don't always know or understand. And if you're looking at the religious history of that area, covering the Bible gets you a long ways down the road, but then you go over there and you realize the Roman Empire occupied this, that has its thumbprint, mother of Constantine. This is the problem with trying to teach impromptu. I get Catherine the Great in my head because of Russia. Anyways, she, you know, traveled over, tried to identify a lot of spots that were of significance to Christianity, and then would build churches on top of them. Our tour guide is fond of pointing out that the Sea of Galilee, that the Israelites really like, because it's the one Christian site that's too large for the Catholic Church to put a church on top of. But everywhere else, the birth of Jesus, the death of Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount, you'll find churches everywhere. So the Roman Empire certainly put its thumbprint on that. So did the Byzantines, especially the Byzantine Empire did. The life in the Crusades, when you had Christians and Muslims and Jews all fighting over that, over Jerusalem and the surrounding area. And then, of course, Ottoman occupation, the Mamluks before that, the Ottoman occupation after that. You can't go into Israel and really appreciate the existing lay of the land, existing buildings and structure, if you don't have a little bit of understanding of the flow of these major occupational periods in the history of Israel since the close of the New Testament period. And so we're going to look at a very broad sweep of that for our last session 2 weeks from tonight. So we got a video. This is a YouTube video. If you do a search on Palestine Roman Empire on YouTube, it's the first video that comes up. It's referred to as Palestine during that time period, in part because that's what Rome called it. It would not have been what Jesus or what most Jews would have identified the land as, but there's always this juxtaposition of people identifying that region, not just today, but going back to the Roman period. Is this the home of the Philistines or the Palestinians? Is it Palestine? Is it the home of the Canaanites? Is it Canaan? Is it the home of the Israelites? Is it Israel? And the answer is it's all of the above. It just depends on who was in control at any one particular time. And so if you search YouTube, Palestine, Roman Empire, it'll pull up this video. I've ducked in about a minute, and Mike's going to roll the video here just for a couple of minutes so you can see kind of a broad sweep of what Israel was like during the Roman Empire, which is the entirety of the New Testament. Before you do, Mike, keep in mind, did Garrett talk some about the intertestamental period last week? Okay. The Old Testament closes around 400 years before the time of Christ. We go four centuries before the birth of Jesus. And I know in the grand scope of talking about world history, 400 years doesn't seem like that long of a period of time when we're talking about millennia. But if you stop and think, 400 years, really a lot changes in civilizations, cultures, sociology. A lot can change in 400 years. Look at our own country over the last 100 years, 200 years, 300 years. 400 years is a long period of time. We leave the Old Testament with Persia in power. We enter the New Testament with Rome in power, which means that the biblical accounts completely skip over this little thing that was Alexander the Great, the rise of Hellenism, the spread of Greek culture all over the world at that time, the death of Alexander the Great, the fracturing of his empire into four different regions, That had a huge effect on the land of Israel. If you have a Bible that has the apocryphal books in it, a Catholic Bible perhaps, actually you can find it online, the books of the Maccabees speak to some of the Jewish history during that time period, the Jews fighting for their independence from the Seleucids or the Ptolemies. Those were two of the ruling houses of the Greek Empire coming out of Alexander the Great. And that, of course, gives birth to the holiday or the celebration of Hanukkah in the Jewish calendar. But that all lands in this 400-year window of time, and then the Greek Empire falls to the Romans, the rise of Rome. We miss a lot of world history and a lot of influence in Israel that isn't accounted for simply in the Bible, but does clearly. We leave a very Eastern world, Babylon, Persia, Israel, Egypt, in the Old Testament. When we enter the New Testament, we've transitioned into Western history because Greece and its language and its arts, its government has spread out all over the Eastern world and leaves its influence in the form of Rome. And so we have very much a Western influence at the time that we enter. And so Israel is kind of caught in between. You know, Jesus is still going to be speaking Aramaic. Most of the disciples are going to be speaking Aramaic. But the secular world, the business world, much of the Roman Empire does business in Greek. So much so that whereas the Old Testament would be written in Hebrew and some Aramaic, the New Testament is entirely written in Greek. Different worlds. And so keep that in mind. We come into the first century. Rome is in power, and Israel is under Roman occupation, rule by foreigners. And people don't love that. They didn't love it when it was Greece. They didn't love it when it was Babylon. They certainly don't love it while it's Rome. So hit play for us, Mike, and we'll go a couple of minutes into this. I should give commentary since it's script and maybe hard for some to read. He's given a bar graph on the lengths of time on occupations or rulers over Rome, starting with Roman rule, 64 BC to 390, about 350 years, Byzantine rule after that, the caliphates, that would be Islamic crusades and Mongols after that, the Mamluks, then the Ottomans, those would be based in Turkey, followed by a very brief period of British mandate of the region of Palestine that preceded the State of Israel, beginning 1948 to present. You see, caliphates and Ottoman rule, the two of the Islamic periods, the largest on that bar graph. And so then back to simply an outline of Roman rule over the area, beginning 37 BC to 6 AD. Many of the Jewish kings would be clients of the Roman Empire. Augustus Caesar would be the Roman emperor. We know him from the story of Jesus whenever a census was called for. Made Israel a Roman province in 6 AD, deposing the last Jewish king. That's probably around the time Jesus was born. From 6 to 64, the following events took place. Jesus was born, ordered to kill. That would be the babies born in Bethlehem. Or that may be referring to his Jesus execution. 12 apostles of Christianity came. They were all Jews, among whom Paul decided to abandon circumcision for Christians, making Christianity more accessible to Gentiles, I should say. From 66 AD to 115, Jews rose in revolt against the Romans, named their state as Israel. Rebellion was crushed, and a victory arch was built in celebration of that defeat. 131 to 136, several major revolts. Bar Kokhba's a name you'll hear. Really, the more significant revolt was in that period before. Okay, Mike, let's stop there. You know, from 136 to 390, that's the period where Constantine makes Christianity the official religion of Rome, and Christianity went from being highly persecuted to being Constantine lining up his soldiers, marching them in one side of the river and out the other, and declaring them to be baptized Christians. We're always suspicious of church and state being joined together, but when it's our own church joined with state, for some reason we're okay with it. I don't know that it served Christianity much better whenever it was in favor with Rome than whenever it was opposed to, when Rome was opposed to it. But it did afford a lot more peace and comfort for the Christian church, which would continue to grow and spread. So we're looking at chapter 17 in the Bible Atlas, if you're carrying that with you. Politics of Palestine. Rome is ruling what was once the Greek Empire, and you don't see a huge map of the Roman Empire in the book, but on page 208 you see kind of the Roman provinces, how they had subdivided up the land of Israel for rule. They had a single king over the entire region. His name was Herod the Great, and we know about him because of the New Testament, the accounts of Jesus. We have more information about him from the Roman history. He started out being a really good king. He kind of started losing, it's believed, started losing some of his sanity later in life. He so badly wanted to be accepted by the Jews. And so the second temple that had stood from the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, 400s AD, it had stood there for over four centuries. Herod comes in and says, we can refurbish this, we can remodel this, we can make this as grand as the temple was when Solomon was king. If you recall in some of the Old Testament prophets, it speaks about the Jews coming and weeping at the second temple because it was so much lacking compared to the grandeur of the first temple. Well, Herod comes in, and one of the ways he thinks he can get the Jews to accept him more is to pour a bunch of money and labor into their temple and bring it back up to its former glory, or at least close to it. If you travel to the site of the Temple Mount, the Western Wall that you see pictures of, and you see people going and praying at the Western Wall, that is the remnant of Herod's temple. It's the oldest part of the temple, the only part remaining, and that was a product of Herod's remodel. He didn't tear it down and rebuild it. He just beautified it, did a big overhaul. Later on in life, the historians say it would have been better to be Herod's dog than one of Herod's kids, one of his sons. He kept having paranoia episodes, thinking one of his sons was trying to assassinate him and take the throne, and so he would have his family members killed to prevent that from happening. He started losing a grasp on sanity, and so when we see the wise men, the account of the Magi from the east coming through, and they say, "Where is the king of the Jews?" And Herod decides to have all the babies in Bethlehem killed. That account is consistent with how Herod the Great was operating in extra-biblical accounts. He was operating much the same way with his own family, so afraid that somebody was going to come and kill him and take his spot on the throne that he was willing to eliminate any possible threat. The dating of the Christian era was done, you know, in the first several centuries. The Roman calendar was established. They didn't know precisely when Jesus was born. They did a kind of a best guess. Later on, we've been able to determine a more precise time for the death of Herod the Great. And you see that in the chart on page 207, his death in 4 BC. So if we're with pretty fair accuracy can identify the death of Herod the Great in 4 BC, that means Jesus had to have been born before that, which means our zero pivot point is not 100% accurate. There's lots of theories and evidence and arguments made for the specific timing of the birth of Jesus. Most people will put it around 6 BC. You got to have time for Jesus to be born, for Magi to come to Bethlehem to see Jesus, for Mary and Joseph to be in a more permanent location, for them to leave, for Herod to issue a mandate that all male children 2 years and under be put to death in the city, and for Mary and Joseph to flee prior to the time of Herod dying in 4 BC. So roughly B.C. 6 for the birth of Jesus. After Herod's death, there wasn't anybody really of his caliber that they wanted to put over the whole region, and so they chose three of his sons and subdivided the territories. And that's part of what this map on page 208 illustrates. They chose Archelaus to rule the region of Judea, and he, in short order, was replaced. He was judged to be a little bit of a judged to be a poor ruler, incapable of occupying the post. And after that, Judea would be ruled directly with a prefect instead of having a governor. That's why, and we'll have several of those. And when we come around to the time of Jesus' trial and execution, we have Pontius Pilate was a prefect, and Pilate wants to send Jesus to Herod Antipas, who was a governor. Herod Antipas was one of the other three sons of Herod, and he was given rule in the region of Galilee and Perea. Perea, the other side of the Jordan River in modern-day Jordan. Pilate says, this is taking place in Jerusalem, but Jesus is from Galilee. This should be Herod's problem. So he sends Jesus to see Herod Antipas, who happened to be visiting Jerusalem at the time. Herod Antipas doesn't take the bait, sends Jesus back to Pilate. This is taking place in your city. I'm not going to put my neck on the line. Herod Antipas, one of the sons of Herod. The other one was, his name was Philip. And Philip was given some of the other regions that you see there further north. On a lot of Israel trips, staying at the Sea of Galilee, one of the day trips is up to Caesarea Philippi. There are two Caesareas. One is on the sea, Caesarea Maritima, Caesarea by the sea. That has a palace of Herod the Great located on it. The other one is Caesarea Philippi. It's inland and further north, kind of at the base of the mountains. And that was a city built by Philip the Tetrarch, the son of Herod the Great. It was a location that's believed to have been an escape place for Jesus and the disciples when they were trying to get away from Galilee, trying to get away from the crowds and the noise, escape to pray. And so Caesarea Philippi is on a lot of tour itineraries for the Holy Land. It's a beautiful place, for one. It probably has connections with the disciples and their early ministry, but it was a city built by Philip whenever he was given control of that part of the land of Israel after his father's death. So Roman government is confusing. They ruled from Rome, and they're trying to rule lands very, very far away. And so they would use whatever system they could. Governors in some cases, kings in some cases, prefects in some cases, and the system would shift based on how effective it tended to be. Did Philip build the other Philippi? I believe he did. The other Philippi from Paul's visit to the church in Philippi, where our letter from Philippians comes from, I'm not sure if that was him or not. That's located in Greece, and so I think
the chart mentions two Philips.
It does. Okay. Which chart are you looking at, Debs?
207.
Philip, he's usually referred to as Philip the Tetrarch, the son. Herod Philip was son of Herod the Great. So yeah, I'm not sure where Philippi in Greece was named after. Who's the Macedonian king? Was that Philip? Philip of Macedon? For some reason that rings a bell that it might have been him. You see some other names in history there if you're curious to learn more about the Roman government. From a biblical point of view, Jesus' issues were less with the Roman government and more with the Jewish religious government. The thing about Rome, they wanted to exercise civic rule. They did not want to get into having to legislate or rule on Israelite religious matters. And so they pretty much gave the Jews freedom to rule and legislate on their own religious issues. And that's where the Sanhedrin comes in. When you hear the Sanhedrin in New Testament accounts, that was the court for religious matters pertaining to Judaism. The Romans didn't necessarily have a problem with Jesus. It was the Jews that had a problem with Jesus, the Jewish leaders. And of course, they charged Jesus with claiming to be king of the Jews, hoping and believing that that would rile up the Romans, because that made of it, the title king, made of it a more civic offense than Jesus claiming to be a Messiah, which was entirely part of their religion. They weren't going to get action on a claim to be Messiah. But king, sure. One of the other things significant about the backgrounds of this time period is the discussion on 2:12 about the sects of Judaism during this time period. Sanhedrin wasn't a sect; they were the court. The two biggest sects of Judaism were Pharisees and Sadducees. And when you think of sects, it's largely like what we would identify as denominations in Christianity: Catholicism, Orthodoxy, Protestantism, the big camps. If you're thinking Islam, you've got Sunnis and Shiites. It's part of the same religion, but just like within Christianity, they didn't necessarily see eye to eye, interpret their texts the same way, practice their religion the same way, and whenever you subdivided on those categories, they didn't always get along. The Pharisees are the ones we seem to be most familiar with because they crop up in the Gospels the most. The reason why they pop up in the Gospels the most is because they were the sect of the common people. They were more, for the everyday worker, the everyday man. They were very, very popular and very present in Jewish society. The Sadducees would be the second most prominent one. And the Sadducees were the wealthy, ruling, powerful priority. You can easily see how, depending on what era of American politics, the stereotypes tend to be, not in reality, but stereotypes in parts of our past, that one party might be the common people's, the middle class party, one might be the upper class party, one caters to the wealthy, one caters to the everyman. This was reality. The Pharisees were the common people's, sect of Judaism. The Sadducees were more the wealthy and ruling class. So there were some different, theological ideas, but in large part they just, they didn't get along. They coexisted, but the Pharisees were much more prominent and much more populous, while the Sadducees had a great deal more influence, especially within the capital city of Jerusalem. Those were not the only two. The Essenes, I think of the Essenes the way they weren't necessarily mystics, but they were kind of the goofy outsiders. And if you know much about Islam, the Sufis in Islam are kind of mystical outsiders. If you know Kabbalah is kind of that for Judaism. For Christianity, I don't know that we have anything that we'd point specifically to as mysticism, but some of the, especially the extreme edges of charismatic Christianity can kind of border into what we would say is a little bit more, just by saying charismatic, it seems to be a little bit more on the mystical edges of their religion. What's that? Yeah, snake handlers. Yeah, I'm not talking about just your basic, we raise hands and maybe speak in tongues, but some of the fringe extremes on charismata in Christianity. The Essenes would have represented this, not that they were mystics, but they were very much fringe outsiders, almost wanting to completely abandon Jerusalem, abandon the temple, abandon the systems. They were very critical and outspoken of the Jewish system, the chief priests, the Sanhedrin, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, everything. They were protesters, revolters. It is believed that John the Baptist might have fit into kind of that. If he wasn't an Essene, he very much kind of appears to be an Essene spirit, living out in the wilderness, in the desert, dressing in, burlap, eating bugs, that kind of attitude. The Essenes were very much off the radar of biblical studies until the 1950s, whenever we started finding these little clay jars that had scrolls of the Hebrew Bible in it in the Judean desert near the Dead Sea. And clearly, by the way, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which, you know, you can read entire books about, you can go visit. There's a Dead Sea Scroll Museum in Jerusalem. I'm not sure if that's on the permanent itinerary. I think it is on the permanent itinerary. If it's not, it's an option on the day off for the free day that you have in Jerusalem. The Dead Sea Scrolls are significant. There were lots of the manuscripts that are biblical texts, but there are also a lot of manuscripts that were extra-biblical. They talked about the community life. And so they teach us that there was some community of very pious, very spiritual Jews living out in the desert around the Dead Sea. And it talks about their rule of law, community life there, how they practiced their faith, how they thought about the Messiah or the coming Savior of the Hebrew people. It gives us insight into what this community was. And scholars debate back and forth whether that community was a Sadducean community, an Essene community, or something else. But in large part, the general consensus among academia is that that was an Essene community living around the Dead Sea. How those scrolls got there, nobody really knows. There are lots of theories. But some have theorized that the Essenes were, the Qumran community was very critical of the established leadership in Jerusalem. Very, very critical of them. And so whether they did this at an earlier time or whether they did this in the lead up to the destruction of the temple by the Romans in 70 AD, the belief is that they managed to take scrolls out of the temple or copy scrolls and then carry them out of the temple. And texts and scrolls that would have never survived the Roman destruction of the temple survived because this Qumran community had copies of them in clay pots out in the desert. And they managed to survive 2,000 years because of the climate, the very, very dry climate around that part of the desert. It really is fascinating that they were there, that they survived, you know, 2,000 years intact. Some of those scrolls, scholars date them to 150 to 250 BC. And so they're even older than probably the Qumran community itself was as they lived in that part of Israel. So,
they were not sealed up. They were in caves.
Yeah.
Shepherds stayed in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, comments that the clay pots in a lot of cases weren't sealed up, but very, very neatly preserved in different states of preservation, but capable of being read and interpreted. So you have Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes. The fourth major category would be the Zealots. And we identify the Zealots. If the Essenes were rebellious against the religious establishment, the Zealots were rebellious largely against the civic Roman occupation. They really were your rebels, your protesters. And we know Simon the Zealot, as he was referred to, being one of Jesus' disciples. If there had to be political activists or extremists in Israel, that would very likely have been the Zealots. And Jesus happened to have one among the 12 that were the closest to him. So the book has more information there about these sects of Judaism, some pictures of the Qumran area. Page 215, the largest intact text from the Hebrew Bible is the Isaiah scroll, and that's what's pictured there on 215. By the way, I think every book in the Old Testament is represented somewhere in the Qumran fragments, maybe with the exception of Esther, and if you assume Ezra and Nehemiah were together as a single writing, which many scholars do. I think there were parts of Ezra, maybe not Nehemiah, or I think it's the other way around. Parts of Nehemiah, but not Ezra. So from a religious and political world, those are two of the big factors at play when you come into the New Testament. The Roman landscape and the landscape of Second Temple Judaism in the first century. And it really helps to have an understanding of some of these terms. I remember as a kid and even as a college student, you know, and people would throw around Sadducees and Sanhedrin and Pilate and prefect and governor and Herod and Caesar and all these words, just assuming that you kind of understand the governmental structure. You're working with two governmental structures, Roman civic structure and Judaism and its religious structure, and they don't always see eye to eye. Very, very complex, and we can perhaps be appreciative that we don't, you know, kind of have that same dynamic in our world today. Questions or comments about any of that? Chapter 18 begins on page 216, Life and Ministry of Jesus. Hopefully by now, as we work through coming to the end of our second year of Jesus' ministry, you've got a little bit of the geography of Israel down. Jesus born in Bethlehem, that would be in the south, in close proximity to Jerusalem. When you travel to Bethlehem today, it is in Palestinian territory. The Church of the Nativity is located there. A picture of it on 217. All the events that we identify with Jesus taking place in Jerusalem are, you know, he didn't spend a great deal of time there. Normally Jesus spent all of his time in the north, and he would travel to Jerusalem for feasts or festivals. And he would travel in, probably stay a very brief number of days, and then travel back out again. And yet, we get stories about him healing the lame man at the pool of Bethesda. We know that he had encounters with Mary and Martha, healing of Lazarus when Lazarus died. Their home would have been in Bethany, which is about 2 miles back then, about 2 miles to the, I believe, the east of Jerusalem. Today, it's just kind of encompassed within modern Jerusalem. You stand on the Temple Mount, you can see down the valley up the Mount of Olives to the other side. Most of those pictures that you see of the dome, looking across at the Dome of the Rock and the Temple Mount, are taken from the top of the Mount of Olives, which on just on the other side, it would have been where the city of Bethany was located. So that was Jesus' trip during Passion Week into Jerusalem and then back out to Bethany every day. We have a lot of content in the city of Jerusalem, but Jesus spent the overwhelming majority of his life and his ministry in the northern province of Galilee. Nazareth was located there. That's where Mary and Joseph had hailed from, where Jesus grew up. The city of Sepphoris would be the capital city of that province during that time. Sepphoris is not an existing city anymore, but it's a huge archaeological site within a walking distance of Nazareth. Nazareth back then was a tiny outpost. Today, it's a very large city, probably having something to do with its tie to Christianity and to Jesus' hometown. Sepphoris is not an existing city. It's not in the Bible, but probably would have been a place that a lot of carpenters in Nazareth might have gone to find work. Capernaum on the Sea of Galilee would be another large location both then. Today, you won't find a city at Capernaum. You'll find archaeological ruins. Instead, you'll find the larger city of Tiberias to the south. But that was Jesus' world. He largely stayed in Galilee. There's a section in Luke where he went into the region of Perea. It's called the Perean ministry. That was also ruled by Herod Antipas. That's that region on the other side of the Jordan River. We have a couple of instances where Jesus crossed the Sea of Galilee into what's known as the Decapolis. We have the Gerasene demoniac, where Jesus cast the demon into the pigs. That was a sermon text just a few weeks back. Whenever we visit Jordan and the city of Jeresh, Jeresh is connected with the Gerasene. And so not necessarily that Jesus went into the city of Jeresh, but that the man who had been cast out into the tombs outside the city, that's likely where his residence was in the city that it's referring to there. Most of Jesus' time was away from Judea. And if you understand the political climate a little bit, you can understand why. If Jesus had gone to Jerusalem and spent all of his time doing there what he was doing in Galilee, his ministry probably would have been much, much shorter than it turned out to be. He would have found himself on the wrong end of the Pharisees and Sadducees and Sanhedrin and Roman rulers quite quickly. It was easier for him to be in Galilee. People would go out to see him, but he was, he was off the beaten path. As I've mentioned, I think, in a sermon or two, it's a whole lot easier to be off the radar of the powers that be if you're in Wyoming or Utah than it is if you're in Washington, D.C. or New York City. And Jesus was about as far away as he could be from Jerusalem and still be amongst the Israelite people. John the Baptist, Todd mentioned, the possibility of him being an Essene, or at least Essene-like. There's a discussion about him operating in the wilderness and, of course, baptizing in the Jordan River. We'd love to know the exact place where John the Baptist baptized. We'd love to know the exact spot where Jesus baptized. There are parts of the Jordan River that are very beautiful and very picturesque. They're further north, closer to the mouth of the river as it comes out of the Sea of Galilee. Where we'll stop, if anybody wanted to get baptized on this trip or any other trip, one of the most popular places is up there further north. Very beautiful, green, lush. Chances are John was baptizing closer to Jerusalem, closer to where the Jordan River empties into the Dead Sea. And you get down there, it's much more deserted. It's wilderness kind of territory, not nearly as beautiful. And it doesn't look like the picture is painted in the backdrop of the baptistry in most Baptist churches. It looks kind of barren and sparse. But chances are that's more likely the location or the area where John would have been baptizing. Much of his time in Jesus, you see some comments there on page 220 about Nazareth, Capernaum, Bethsaida, the Decapolis. On most tours of the Holy Land, there's a beautiful site on the location believed to be where Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount. The Catholic Church built a nice church there. It is serene. It's picturesque. It's really pretty. As far as Capernaum, there's not much there. A lot of sites we'll visit. You see on the map, the top of 221, Tabgha. That's the traditional location for the multiplication of loaves and fishes. And then also the town of Cana is another site, much closer to the city of Nazareth, where the traditional location, the stated location where Jesus attended the wedding feast. And when you go there, you can buy actual wine from Cana. It's terrible. You can buy it if you want. It is, as far as wine goes, it's not the best. It's definitely not the wine that Jesus made when he turned water into wine and saved the best for last. It's clearly not that. But some comments. We've mentioned Jesus outside of Galilee. You see, we've really not said much about Samaria. And the maps on page 224, 225, again, illustrate. We talk at length about Galilee and about Judea, but you did have that third region of Israel in the middle and was very much kind of the outcast land of the country. At the risk of being very, very stereotypical and with apologies to them, even in our country, we kind of have those parts of the country who would say, yeah, that's... take your pick. West Virginia a lot of times gets picked on. Arkansas gets picked on sometimes. It was different than the surrounding area and much of the rest of the country. Samaria was that. It was hybrid religion. It was hybrid ethnicity. They kind of kept to themselves. They definitely did not get along with the Jews, Orthodox Jews in Galilee and in Judea. And you will recount the stories of Jesus insisting on traveling through Samaria early in the book of John when he encounters the woman at the well. I like the map on 225 because it shows two possible routes you could take to get from Galilee to Judea, and the one that most Jews would take, skirting the edge of the territory right along the Jordan River Valley so as to avoid any encounters with Samaritans. And then, of course, Jesus' route that went right through the middle of it. One of those things that we really, really do appreciate and value about him. So, in Jerusalem, a lot of interesting information in the book as far as there's a long excursus starting on page 228, Jerusalem in the days of Herod and Jesus. There's reconstruction at the bottom of 227. You see a picture of the village of Bethany at the top of that page. And then some modern images, the Temple Mount, the Western Wall on 230. We talked about it the last time that I was here lecturing. The city of Jerusalem is tough because it's just been consistently occupied nonstop since the time of Jesus, really since the time of David, really going back before the time of David, even under destruction. The temple and the palaces would be leveled, but people still lived within the city. And so archaeology's tough because you just have layer after layer after layer of destruction and resettlement and rebuilding and destruction and resettlement and rebuilding. And archaeology's tough because you still have people living and working around the city. And the city has continued to grow just like, you know, I mean, it's a major modern global city today. And we can talk about Bethlehem and Bethany and the Mount of Olives. All these areas were outlying areas to David's Jerusalem and even Herod's and Jesus's Jerusalem. Today, it's just like talking about Houston and Bel Air and Memorial and, you know, Clear Lake and Kingwood. I mean, it just all bleeds together. So trying to get your head around and even to get a visual of Jerusalem during the time of Herod is pretty tough. Walking through the old city of Jerusalem is really, it's one of my favorite things to do there. It feels old. You can imagine it kind of looking that way during the time of Jesus. But the reality is that the level of building around the old city of Jerusalem today is probably Ottoman. Our tour guide will tell us, I don't recall, Ottoman era. Some of it's Ottoman, some of it Byzantine era. It doesn't go back even to the Roman occupation. It just feels old. They've kept it, you know, some state of preservation. But hard to get your head around it. The archaeological site at the city of David is one place that kind of, you know, flies in the face of that tendency. And that is just outside the Temple Mount wall. I was trying to see if there was a picture of the old city of David on here. I don't believe there is. And then, of course, the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, because it goes back to Herod's temple. A couple of places where that is the exception. Remains of the Pool of Bethesda, you see the picture on the bottom of 228, just north of the temple area. There are a couple of places in the city that have these large-scale models of what Jerusalem was believed to look like. I believe, in fact, that is the model if you look on 232. It's located, I believe, at the Dead Sea Scroll Museum. It's on the tour, maybe at one of the parks. Does this say on here? I think it's at one of the parks. But it is on the travel itinerary for most trips. That model, you see, both of those pictures are of that model. So the picture on the bottom of 233 is that's standing at the Temple Mount looking the other way, the Mount of Olives, and up over that hill would be the city of Bethany. Talking about the last week of Jesus, I mean, that's the trip from Bethany to Jerusalem and back again. And in the valley, you see all those olive trees. That's where the Garden of Gethsemane would be located today. It's a big cemetery up there near the top of the mount. You can kind of make it out on that picture, but The Garden of Gethsemane is another place where we have a good Catholic church. You know, you can kind of walk through there. There are olive trees in the garden that they believe are centuries old. I mean, they're really good. Olive trees live forever in a day. And they're olive trees centuries old, 800 years, 1,000 years, and some perhaps even older than that. And so it's another place in the city where you can kind of get a feel for what the lay of the land might have been like when Jesus and his disciples were there. It is controlled by the Catholic Church, and so you don't always have easy access to it. The first time I went, we were able to go in and walk around. The second time I went, it was gated off, closed, and we didn't have access to it. So you never know. I wouldn't doubt it, yeah. His comment that the city had been built up 6 feet because of the ruins, and in some cases, Todd, maybe even more than that. So, it's way down, isn't it? Way down. You see the Church of the Holy Sepulchre on the bottom of 235. That is built over what is the traditional location of the burial of Jesus. It's very hard to visualize it because we think of Jesus being buried in a tomb, and here it's kind of a church has been built over it, and it's wide open, and there's this big kind of Holy of Holies-ish sort of thing you pass through. Hard to visualize, but the location of Jesus' tomb to this location goes back very, very far. There's a group of British scholars that have identified another place that they think looks much more similar, like like Golgotha, that the hill looked like a skull, and they've built kind of a visiting area. It's much more peaceful, serene, garden-esque. There's an actual tomb cut into the rock. You can kind of go in and see what it might have looked like. That location is great because it kind of gives you an idea of what the traditional location might have been like. Most scholars do not believe that was the actual location. So you kind of have to take the two and put them together. And this is what it might have looked like back then, even though this is where it was back then, but looks nothing at all like now what it looked like then. And the trip that we take visits both of those locations. So, Helena, thank you. Mother of Constantine, is that correct? I thought I had that right. Helen, maybe that's what they refer to her as. Just a few minutes left. Chapter 19, kind of the early expansion of the church. From a background's point of view, this really constitutes the book of Acts. And of course, Paul's missionary journeys are going to wander far from Israel. And if you want more of the early Christian spread of the church, then you have to go on the Greece trip, or we have to put together a Turkey trip. A lot of these locations in modern-day Turkey, Antioch, Izmir, Ephesus, a lot of significant locations in modern-day Turkey. Or you go to Rome, you go to Italy. Italy, Greece, Turkey, the other three big countries where Paul and Peter and likely John traveled according to the biblical account. In the tradition of Christianity, the other disciples spread out and went other places too. We just don't have biblical accounts of that. It's believed that Thomas went towards India, that he might have gone east and taken Christianity to that part of the world, that you had other disciples perhaps moving towards Africa. We just don't have hard evidence, hard documentation. Those are traditions that have been passed down in oral tradition in those communities for centuries, and so we don't really know. The biblical account, because they were in the Roman Empire, the Roman world, it recounts the spread of Christianity within the Roman world. Within Israel, much of what you have is the church in Jerusalem staying an existing presence. It was likely the only church until the persecution of the Christians. Stephen was stoned, was put to death, and then it caused a lot of the Christians to flee. And then we hear about Philip and Peter sharing the gospel in areas around Judea, around in Samaria, into Galilee, and the church began cropping up in other parts of Israel. Paul, in much of his journeys, would take up a collection in cities in Asia Minor and in Greece and take collections back for the church in Jerusalem. He considered to speak of the Christians in Jerusalem as being a persecuted group, a church that needed help. And so he would collect offerings from the other churches he would visit and then take back or send back to the church in Jerusalem. James traditionally believed to be half-brother of Jesus, one of the sons of Mary and Joseph, was not one of the 12 disciples, but likely one of the followers of Jesus, definitely one of the early church leaders. When Peter and Paul and John are spreading out and going on missionary travels, James would stay in Jerusalem and was the de facto leader of the Jerusalem church for much of that period of the spread of Christianity. And so Christianity's home, it was born in Jerusalem. It stayed in Jerusalem for a long period of time. There is a Baptist church in the city of Nazareth. A lot of Baptist tours go through Nazareth for no other reason than to go see the Baptist Church of Nazareth. It's a church, and there's... Yeah, yeah. I think there's a school affiliated with it as well. The Christian population of the nation of Israel is very, very small. It is not large or significant. Once upon a time, the Christian population of Palestine was greater than the Christian population of Israel. More Christians in Palestine than in Israel. The Christians in Palestine have undergone a great deal of persecution there, and a number of them have fled into other places. And so now I'm not so sure that the population of Christians in Palestine and Israel isn't comparably low in both places. Some of these tour guides, because they know they're bringing Christian groups over, there are a couple of places where you've got Christian families that make their living running souvenir shops that sell items to Christian tour groups that come over there. One in particular in the region of Palestine, when you go in to visit Bethlehem, you see people that bring back all these olive wood nativity sets and Christmas ornaments and things like that. That's one particular store. It's run by a Christian family. It's pretty hard to have a job and make a living in Palestine as Christians. Very, very Islamic and not a place of great religious freedom. Palestine isn't, but the reality is that Israel really isn't either. You'll find in Israel a great deal of cultural religion, not as much. It's secularly religious in a lot of ways that our country happens to be. But the state religion is Judaism, and it is prevalent everywhere. So. Really. The Bresnik family, if you guys know Randy and Rebecca's family, somewhere in her extended family was a gentleman that owned some land in Israel, and he donated land in Jerusalem for the building of the YMCA. There's a YMCA near the old city. It's a very well-known location, visited by prominent businessmen and people throughout the area. If you're there or when we're there, you have the opportunity to see it. It's a Christian presence in the city. But then also donated some land up on the Sea of Galilee for kind of a camp for Christian work. And so Rebecca has been very much involved with people in both of those locations, trying to keep them as a presence of Christianity in a country that doesn't seem to really want a presence of Christianity. Interesting to hear her, talk about it and share some of the background and history on those. And that's a very interesting tie to the Christian work in Israel, tied back to our church here. So, pretty cool.
Great book to read if you're going to Jerusalem. Our Jerusalem.
Our Jerusalem?
By the daughter of Spatman.
Okay.
He's the one who wrote as well as my soul is actually moving.
Gotcha.
And this is written by a daughter who's born after.
Born later. In Jerusalem.
Dedicated their house, one of their houses, as a Christian relief. And you can still go to that house.
Yeah.
Find
book recommendation, if you're on the Facebook live stream, is called Our Jerusalem.
Bertha Spafford
is the author's name. The title is Our Jerusalem. It's an interesting place. Jerusalem is, Israel is, but Jerusalem in particular, when they talk about it being the home of three religions, and the Jews call it home, and Christians call it home, and Muslims call it home, you all recognize that even those three religions are so multifaceted. And sometimes, the first time that we were there was after Christmas, and it was a year where a big story in the news was about the Catholic priests and the Orthodox priests. You know, they have different times where they preside over the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, getting into a fight on Christmas Eve, whacking each other with broom handles. And that's just within Christianity. I mean, that's not even bringing the Muslims and Jews into the equation. And so you take all the different manifestations of Christianity, the different traditions within Judaism and Islam. It's a curious place, a curious place to be sure, and very, very fascinating. And so if you haven't been, I'd encourage you to go, whether you're on this trip coming up or whether you make it somewhere in the future. It's definitely worth your time. One of my great disappointments on these trips is that we don't ever spend much time in Tel Aviv, which is supposed to be a beautiful, you know, city today, Tel Aviv being the capital. It just doesn't have any ties to the biblical world and to Christian pilgrimage. And so if you ever want to go do Tel Aviv, you kind of have to do it on your own, or go early or stay late or whatever the case may be. But Jerusalem really is the hub for, you know, for a Christian trip in and out of Israel. Hope you guys, hope to see you on Sunday for worship, and then hope you have a fantastic Thanksgiving next week. And we will come back for one last session 2 weeks from tonight, talk about a lot of these other church developments, Christian developments, religious developments, occupational developments between the close of the New Testament and modern day. We'll talk about those next week, 2 weeks. So hope to see you then.